Jones. And this was in a story by David Zucchino in the L.A. Times, treading on the trappings of Hussein's high life. And that section was soldiers in the private zoos. They knew nothing of the private zoos. At one animal pen, American soldiers now feed live sheep to lions and cheetahs. One soldier, alas, had to shoot the brown bear when the animal escaped its enclosure and refused, even at the point of an M4 rifle, to return inside. At Uday's private zoo, I guess that's one of Hussein's sons, U.S. Special Forces now feed ostriches and gazelles to three mangy lions. The cats snooze under a sign pasted up by the soldiers, anyone caught abusing our pets will be their next meal. Now, my reaction to this is, if the U.S. is going to invade a country, its responsibility is to protect the institutions that are essentially neutral, like zoos, hospitals, public buildings, libraries, banks, things like that. Actually, I don't know how neutral banks are in their own way, but let's put that aside. So what they needed to do is to have people ready for this, or if they didn't have people ready, you fly them in on jets and you help them. You have a zoo expert who comes in and shows you how to feed these animals and take care of them. But no, they're just going to shoot a bear. They're just going to start feeding some of the animals to the other animals. I mean, this is the $70 billion invasion. And what they're doing is not only shooting civilians, but they're shooting animals. I mean, it shows you the attitude, it seems to me, that is being propounded in this invasion. And it just sucks, frankly. Here's another story by Doyle McManus. U.S. to step up its search for banned arms. With its claim that Iraq had hid chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons still unproven, the Bush administration is preparing to dispatch hundreds of additional investigators to step up the search and warning that it may take as long as a year to complete. The Pentagon is assembling a survey group with more than 1,000 experts to interrogate Iraqi scientists and sift through recovered documents to broaden the search for weapons of mass destruction. Officials said U.S. military units in Iraq have found no prohibited weapons since they invaded the country last month, although they have found gas masks, protective gear, and antidote kits. Some experts, both inside and outside the U.S. government, say Iraq's weapons programs may turn out to be significantly smaller than the Bush administration has portrayed them. And some say missteps in military units' initial searches of suspected weapon sites may have unwittingly destroyed useful evidence. But administration officials say they are still certain that the regime of Saddam Hussein was developing and hiding weapons of mass destruction, and that the evidence will eventually turn up. The U.S. contention that Hussein was holding chemical and biological weapons, and he might give some of them to terrorists, was the administration's principal rationale for going to war. We are quite confident of our intelligence, Secretary of State Colin L. Powell said in a television interview last week. When the searching is all over and the evidence comes forward, then this conflict will rest on a solid foundation of fact. Just keep your fingers crossed and keep watching. But officials, that's my addition, have also begun an effort to lower public expectations, emphasizing how difficult it will be to find the evidence and how long it may take for the weapons to be found. It is not like a treasure hunt where you just run around looking everywhere hoping you find something, Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld said last week. The United Nations inspectors didn't find anything, and I doubt that we will. What we will do is find the people who will tell us. It's going to take time to find anything because, and I read this before, they buried things they used underground tunnels. They took the documentation, Rumsfeld said. Army General Tommy Franks, head of the U.S. Central Command, who directed the war in Iraq, said recently the weapons search could take as long as a year. Officials maintain they are not frustrated or disappointed that evidence of their principal charge against Hussein has not yet turned up, but they acknowledge that they will face mounting skepticism from critics of the war the longer the search takes. The issue will come up this week in the UN Security Council, which has summoned Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix to report on the situation. Blix clashed with the Bush administration before the war began when he argued that his inspections should be allowed to continue. Since the war, he has noted acerbically that the U.S. has found no more evidence of Iraqi weapons than he did. Blix said last week that he was ready to put a team of UN inspectors back in Iraq within 2 weeks. I think that the world would like to have a credible report on the absence or eradication of the program of weapons of mass destruction, he told the BBC. The Bush administration says it is too early for U.N. inspectors to return to Iraq and expresses little interest in Blix's services. This seems to be the week of voluntarism. I've read this before, too. And on the part of people who say they're willing to get rid of Iraqi weapons that aren't willing to admit that they were there before, a senior U.S. official said the administration isn't worried that critics may not find any U.S. discoveries credible without international monitors on the scene. The official said there will always be people who believe we never landed on the moon, he said. Besides, it won't just be Americans. There will be Iraqi scientists talking about what they did, too. Part of the problem, U.S. officials said, is that the effort to find the weapons is now only now getting underway in earnest. Until now, the effort has been run through the 75th Exploitation Task Force, a unit of several hundred military and civilian experts that follow the Army and Marines into southern Iraq. But to interrogate scientists and scour documents all over the country, the Pentagon is only now assembling the full-scale Iraq Survey Group, which will include more than 1,000 experts in fields ranging from nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons to linguistics and conventional munitions. Most of the team is still in the United States, waiting until travel in Iraq is safe, officials said. The 75th is sort of our advance organization, if you will, a member of the group said. When the Iraq Survey Group stands up, it's going to be a much more capable organization. The 75th has already searched more than a dozen suspected weapon sites and started collecting Iraqi military documents. Once collected, the documents are scanned and downloaded into a classified U.S. military intelligence computer network known as Harmony for further analysis. But some experts have said that the initial effort appears to have gone awry. I'm not sure we went about this in the most efficient fashion, said William C. Potter, director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He said he was shocked to learn that Marines had bumped into the Tuwafa Nuclear Research Center, the focal point of Iraq's civilian and military nuclear activities, without knowing what it was, and that former regime members may have succeeded in destroying evidence of their activities. I'm surprised there has not been more unambiguous material and documentation found, particularly in the chemical weapons area, Potter said. I didn't expect to find anything in the nuclear sector, but I was persuaded they had prohibited activities underway in the biological and chemical area. A former UN inspector who asked not to be identified was sharply critical of the U.S. effort so far. Basically, they're making some of the same mistakes we made at the start of the inspections in 1991, he said. When the Marines blew up an Al-Samud missile outside of Al-Kut, do you think anyone disassembled it first to see if any foreign components were in it, or took down the serial numbers to trace parts back to the suppliers, or took precise measurements of the warhead to see what it was designed for? They're destroying things without understanding what it is and how it got there, he said. Officials said the Iraq Survey Group's efforts will rely heavily on Iraqi scientists to lead them to evidence of clandestine weapons programs. But Ewan Buchanan, spokesman for the UN inspection team, said the scientists may not know the answers to the most important questions. The scientists may be useful in figuring out what got made, Buchanan said, but it's not at all clear that they would know where things went or where they're hidden. But Buchanan, spokesman for the UN inspection team, acknowledged that the U.S. teams may get more out of interviews than we did if there's something hidden people under the old environment may not have told us where to look. Rumsfeld announced last week that the United States would pay rewards to anyone providing information about weapons of mass destruction. Iraqi scientists who don't cooperate may be taken to a detention facility for interrogation and ultimately could be charged with war crimes, U.S. officials said. The surrenders this month of two top Iraqi scientists, General Amir Sadi, the main liaison to UN inspection teams for chemical and biological weapons after 1995, and Jafar Jafar, who founded and led Iraq's clandestine nuclear program, raised hopes that the search would soon bear fruit. But both scientists continue to assert that they destroyed everything in the years after the 1991 Persian Gulf War, according to a U.S. intelligence official familiar with the initial debriefings. I will be more surprised if we don't find something than if we do, said Jan Wolfstahl, a non-proliferation expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I expect Saddam buried them deep and hid them well, but as the population opens up and as former military and security people try to win favor with the new authorities, they'll be willing to talk. But he said he's concerned that the administration presented the worst-case scenario when discussing Iraq's weapons. Those worst-case estimates may turn out to be high, he said. What exists there may turn out to be less than what the administration said. David Albright, a former nuclear weapons inspector in Iraq, said he concluded long ago that the administration was overstating the likelihood that Iraq had rebuilt its nuclear weapons program. He said he is increasingly skeptical of claims that Iraq had a huge arsenal of chemical and biological weapons. If there are no weapons of mass destruction, I'll be as mad as hell, Albright said. I certainly accepted the administration's claims on chemical and biological weapons. I figured they were telling the truth. If there are no weapons of mass destruction program, I will feel taken because they asserted these things with such assurance. And that's an L.A. Times story from today's Sunday L.A. Times. So, actually, there's not too much in that story. Again, unidentified sources, intelligence agents, a couple of quotes from Blix and from unnamed U.N. inspectors. And that's sort of the way it is with these mainstream stories, many of them. Looks like we have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Mr. Norris.
Yes, sir.
I've been listening for a little while here, and there's so many things I wanted to say. Most recently, you were reading our news articles, and are still our number one export out of the good old U.S. of A. is weapons and weapons of mass destruction. So if we were righteous, maybe we could police other countries for their weapons of mass destruction, but... You know, feeding other animals to other animals and only guarding the Ministry of Oil is, I think, a little bit less than righteous activity.
Yeah.
Funny stuff. I wonder if there's anybody playing hacky sack over there in Baghdad.
Well, you got to be careful. You might get some of those cluster bombs that look like food packages.
Yeah. Maybe they make them that look like hacky sack.
I would hope not. Actually, I've seen a couple hacky sack players back on the mall, but they're kind of like guerrilla hacky sack players. They come and they go, you know.
Yeah, and quickly, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that whole thing is just incredibly preposterous. I mean, these people aren't hurting anybody. I mean, maybe a hacky sack lands in your coffee, but I mean, hopefully that would make you laugh. It's incredible. I mean.
Well, it's a terrorist incident, clearly, and that's why Ed Porter was so outraged to hear about it.
The tolerance, you know, tolerance. Whatever happened to tolerance? It's just incredible. And I wanted also very much to thank you and for the work that you do for the people that you work for. And, you know, City Hall and all these people who I know very little of, it seems to me that they get paid for the work that they do, and I don't think the people that you're working for are really.
No, they don't. Thank you, caller. Hey, keep those praises coming in, man. I like it. Here's another story: the siphon brigades of Basra. Again, an L.A. Times story. By Robin Dixon, today's LA Times. The thieves come brazenly in daylight, hauling off their cargo on carts and in buckets. Nearly everyone in Basra is stealing water. The water system failed when looters stole parts from electricity substations after British forces took the Iraqi city April 7th. The pumps could not run, so people broke open pumps to take water, and what had been a simple problem suddenly became a lot more complicated to fix. If people stopped stealing, we could get it back to the pre-war status quo in 5 days. I want to interject. That would be the pre-war status quo with sanctions against Iraq, so that you have hundreds of thousands of kids dying in the last 10 years because they can't import the proper medical supplies. But say no more. Let's continue. I said Andres Krusi, head of the International Committee of the Red Cross delegation in Basra, but so many people are siphoning water that engineers have had to send high-salinity river water into the system to keep it flowing. More than half the city's population now has running water, but it is undrinkable. About 40% have no water at all, compared with about 15% before the war. British military officials say that more than 200,000 gallons of drinking water are being distributed daily in this southern city of 1.5 million people, much of it from Kuwaiti tankers under British Guard, but locals still stop reporters in the street to tell them in English the one thing they need most, water. The problem reflects the high expectations Iraqis have of the Allied forces. That sounds like L.A. Times-ese to me, man. And the complexities of meeting those expectations quickly. I guess the expectation is if you're going to blow it up, you better fix it fast if you're there to liberate the people, right? Sorry, I'm throwing in my interjections here. In Basra, the water stopped when British troops took the city, so many people blame them, Cruzi said. The city's chief water engineer, Jabar Haidari, said he drove out to the main plant as the fighting erupted around Basra. The plant was in the south, in the area of the heaviest fighting, and the only way there was to drive toward the British as bombs and mortar shells rained down. The situation was very difficult because there was a lot of bombing and shelling, Haidari said. It was a bad situation, but I was laughing. We were working on the water, so why were they shooting? I had a white flag on my car. As soon as he approached the British soldiers, he said he was arrested and marched more than 2 miles to a place for questioning. The British did not accept his explanation that he needed to maintain the water plant and ordered him to return to the city, Haidari recalled. He later tried again, this time traveling with the Red Cross, and managed to get across the line. He risked his life to keep the water running in wartime, only to see the problem become worse after the shelling ceased. On patrol for problems Saturday, he found broken generators, idle pumps, and pipes that were either destroyed by explosions or spewing geysers from bullet holes. A water tank was badly damaged after being shot by a British tank, according to Abud Abdul Hassan, 53, the local water operator. A local welder was volunteering his services to fix the damage. One water pipe was destroyed when retreating Iraqi forces detonated mines on an adjacent bridge. At one plant, local residents were buying fuel to run generators. Workers for the Basra Water Directorate, who are slowly returning to their jobs, have the tough task of plugging the thousands of holes made by the water thieves. But the most difficult part is to persuade people who have no water not to break into the pipes. In the Yassaf family, with 8 people, it is the job of Mahid, 14, and his brother Mara, 13, to find water and cart it home. Their favorite location is a pipe under a manhole on El Sadeh Street in central Basra, just a block from where Haidari and Red Cross officials gather each day to discuss how to restore the city's water supply to full capacity. The Yassaf brothers aren't buying the explanation that if people stop taking the water, the system could be running properly in a few days. This is government water, Mara said. Nobody said don't do it. It's normal. Everyone takes it. And that's an L.A. Times story. And what else we got here? Now here's a broader story, and again, this is questionable. We're talking about official sources, but it's an L.A. Times story. Not many people read the L.A. Times. You can actually get on the L.A. Times website, by the way, if you're interested, and you can read the paper, but you have to sign in, give a code name, and so forth. And you can't get into the archives unless you start subscribing and paying for it, but you can read the paper if you go to the L.A. Times website. Use a Google search engine, and you should be able to get there. Let's see. It's called Retreat is Part of U.S. Strategy by Esther Schrader. With the threat of Saddam Hussein all but extinguished and Arab suspicions of American intentions running deep, senior administration officials say the U.S. military has been taking steps to significantly reduce its presence in much of the Middle East. And ironically, this article kind of contradicts that, but I'll read some more. Last week's quiet removal of 30 of the 80 fighter jets and almost half of the 4,500 personnel from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, where the U.S. has maintained thousands of troops since the 1991 Persian Gulf War, is just the beginning, officials said. Within months, the Pentagon plans to close down most of its operations at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, leaving only a skeleton crew, and to move most of its aircraft and troops out of Qatar and Oman. The plans, which are preliminary and subject to review, are a response to pressure from Arab governments incensed by the U.S. military buildup in the region over the last 12 years, the financial burden of maintaining vast numbers of troops overseas, and the strain it has caused for families and military readiness. One of the unstated goals of the Iraq War was to be able to lance that boil and get out of the steady state of a very high level commitment of forces in an area that not only wears down the force, but causes all sorts of political problems, said retired Army General Joseph P. Hoare, an appropriate name, who commanded U.S. forces in the Mideast from 1991 to 1994 and helped negotiate agreements to base U.S. troops throughout the region after the Gulf War. The Iraqi war has always been envisioned as a way to get out of the need to have forces in place designed to protect against an immediate assault, he said. The plans are in line with Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld's goal of transforming the military into an agile, more easily deployed force. By cutting back on costly overseas deployments in places such as Saudi Arabia, where the Pentagon has spent more than $1 billion a year for much of the last decade, Rumsfeld hopes to have more money for new technologies to modernize the armed forces. In Europe, the Pentagon is reviewing its big military contingents in countries such as Germany and has discussed replacing them with smaller units in Romania, Poland, and Bulgaria that could jump rapidly into hot spots. My interjections might have something to do with the fact that, Germany was not terribly happy with this Iraqi Bush I call it a re-election war, that's what I call it. The decision to shrink what the Pentagon calls its footprint in the Middle East does not for now affect the more than 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Only that many? Pentagon officials said recently that military plans to maintain large numbers of troops in Iraq for at least a year and probably longer. And Defense and State Department officials have been relatively open about their hopes of using the U.S. presence in Iraq as a stabilizing force throughout the region. Since the buildup preceding the Gulf War to drive Hussein's forces from Kuwait, the U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf region has been the subject of increasing tension. Anger at U.S. troops in the area, particularly in Saudi Arabia, home of Islam's two holiest sites, helped fuel the terrorist activity that led to the September 11th attacks. Osama bin Laden has repeatedly called for their removal from his homeland. There's a certain focused hostility in Saudi Arabia to the presence of U.S. troops on Saudi soil, and to the extent that you can change that, you may be able to change some of the dynamic of tensions to U.S. presence around the Arab world, said Jan Alterman, a former member of the policy planning staff at the State Department. It would not make them start singing the Star Spangled Banner, but it would remove or lessen a major irritant to U.S.-Saudi, or more broadly, U.S.-Arab relations. Prince Saud Al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister, suggested that a change in the troop status is only natural in the wake of the Iraq war. This is more of a military question and should be directed to the Ministry of Defense. What I know is that after the war in Iraq, a new reality has emerged, which is bound to reflect on this question, he told the Times. Prince Sultan base was basically used for monitoring the no-fly zone in southern Iraq. One would assume that this would change. Saeed Faghih, a leader of the London-based Saudi opposition, which has been critical of U.S. troops in the kingdom, said he believes the U.S. waited until after the war to save face. They have said that they are aware that their presence of their forces is dangerous to them and gives bin Laden and people like him an excuse to go on arguing against not only America, but also against the Saudi regime being a traitor to religion in the country. So they said if we remove our forces now, they will say Americans are cowards. They're just responding to bin Laden's call. But if we remove the official cause of the forces, which is surveillance of the no-fly zones, then we have an excuse to say we are now reducing our forces. And if we succeed in our campaign in Iraq, nobody will say we are cowards. You're cowards. Excuse me. We do this decision with confidence, not with fear. Even before the build-up for last month's invasion of Iraq, the Pentagon had 20,000 to 25,000 troops and more than 200 aircraft deployed to the Arabian Peninsula, Turkey, Central Asia, and surrounding waters. If the Pentagon follows through in its plans, that number could shrink by more than 12,000 people and more than 100 aircraft within the year, defense officials said. Weaponry and equipment stored for years in warehouses in Kuwait are likely to remain, officials said last week. Small number of U.S. troops will remain in Kuwait, which has been spending more than $200 million a year to maintain a U.S. military presence on its territory and wants at least some U.S. troops to remain, officials said, but the Army battalion that has been deployed there since the early 90s is likely to move out, defense officials said. Skeleton force of U.S. military aircraft and their crews will remain at air bases in Oman, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar. Other troops will rotate into the region regularly to conduct military exercises and maintain the U.S.'s ability to deploy to emerging trouble spots in the region. But the multi-billion-dollar operations in Turkey and Saudi Arabia and the vast buildup of ground troops in Kuwait will soon be history. So too will be much of the U.S. military presence in Central Asia, where the Pentagon refurbished and flew out of the former Soviet air bases to support the war in Afghanistan. And this goes on for some length. I'm not entirely sure why I'm reading it now, but it had some interesting details in there. It's quite a long story. LA Times today. You can check it out further if you'd like. Let's see here. Washington Post in Kut along the Tigris, I guess it's Kut, along the Tigris River. Syed Abbas, a 52-year-old Shiite cleric, has seized the city hall, surrounded by legions of armed supporters who have promised to block the entrance of U.S. troops that have yet to recognize his right to rule the city. In poor Shiite swaths of Baghdad, Mohammed Fartusi, a cleric dispatched by the seminary in Najaf, has claimed authority over an unruly collection of Shiite preachers, some of whom have installed groups of armed men at their mosques. In Najaf, the seminary under Sistani and the followers of Sadir each have moved to administer a city whose very name speaks to centuries of Shiite religious authority. And the point being that there are plenty of armed people getting involved who are asking the U.S. to get out of the country. And this is the war that's winding down, I want to remind all of you. Now for something entirely different. First, a station break. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm The Robe. Phone number here, 427-3772, in case you want to chime in with something. We got a couple of shows coming up on Club Cruise. That's the television show that airs on channel, I think it's 27, maybe it's 26. You can try them both. Every Tuesday and Thursday night at 7 o'clock. And let's see, on April 22nd and 24th, you're going to have Becky Johnson interviewing Richard Quigley on Bad Cops in the Sheriff's Office, Judge Art Danner, and Hopes and Fears for District Attorney Bob Lee. And I guess that's the only show we have a clear statement on. There's some other shows coming up, including one about the war in which I interviewed Joe Williams, who did a pretty good job with Rotkin last week. For those of you who tuned in, we had a debate between Joe Williams and Councilmember Mike Rotkin on the issue of FAR, boon or bane to the Santa Cruz peace movement. And you can actually, you may be able to actually hear that debate soon. I believe it's going to be posted on the Indie Media website. It's actually it's been dubbed last night, and it's going to be uploaded soon. That's at www.santacruz.indiemedia.org. So check that out. Interesting article by Will Potter I picked up off the Counterpunch website. That's not a mainstream website. I recommend it. It's not just protesters anymore when police attack journalists by Will Potter. I have reported on mass protests where police attack protesters, but I tended to accept and even wrote in some articles statements by police that protesters provoked this violence. The crowd got out of control, I thought. Surely someone threw rocks, threw punches, or did something to instigate these assaults. The police would not attack people for no reason. After witnessing and feeling attacks by multiple baton-wielding officers during the permitted anti-war march in the Capitol on April 12th, I realized I have made a mistake. As a reporter, I have mistakenly placed the burden of proof on the protesters rather than the police. And now, as I see the coverage of the protest where I was beaten, I see other journalists doing the same. A local news station showed video footage of an officer beating a restrained protester. So D.C. Police Chief Charles H. Ramsey assigned the officer to desk duty. He said, "I'm not just going to hang this guy out to dry just because someone made an allegation." Media reports of the attacks have towed this line. When journalists state protesters and police clashed and protesters scuffle with police, it leads the public to believe that the protesters brought it upon themselves. If unofficial sources, protesters, say they were beaten, they are making allegations. If official sources, police, say it was an appropriate response, we often treat it as fact. I attended the march as a freelance journalist and was beaten by police with batons while I was wearing my congressional press pass. These attacks were not just allegations. Here's what happened at one point on the march. Near the intersection of 9th and G Streets, police buzzed the crowd on motorcycles, hitting one protester. A scuffle ensued about 40 feet in front of me. Police pepper-sprayed some protesters and then went after everyone in the intersection. Because of the national uproar over last year's controversial mass arrests of World Bank IMF protesters in Pershing Park and lawsuits now pending, police say they have reevaluated their policy on such arrests. True to their word, they didn't go into the crowd arresting innocent people. Instead, they beat them. The melee worked its way back to me as I tried to walk my bicycle toward the sidewalk. Without warning, I was struck on my back by a police officer with a baton who then started yelling, "Clear the streets!" At least five officers used batons to push the crowd towards the sidewalk and against another group of officers. We were caught between two lines of cops swinging batons. When the crowd pushed me against one officer, I told him, "I'm not assaulting you. I'm not trying to touch you. I'm being trampled. Please help." He looked me in the eyes, almost like he was sorry, and said, "I know." I fell from the pressure of panicked people trying to flee. Others collapsed on top of me. I couldn't breathe and yelled for help. An officer behind me pulled at my neck and throat, tearing my shirt, yelling, "Get up!" I couldn't, I told him, because I was being trampled. When I managed to stand and take a few steps, a police officer struck me twice with his baton, held horizontally in both hands. I flew back onto the mass of flailing people. "Clear the street," he yelled. "Back up!" The pile slowly unraveled, and I went for my bike. The same officer who hit me moments before now intentionally stomped on the rear portion of the bike as he yelled, "Move!" I surveyed the damage to my bike and my body and asked officers for badge numbers. They pretended they didn't hear me. Some turned and walked away. Even those that I knew were not directly involved remained silent. They acted like a gang covering for each other. One turned around, pushed me with his baton, and yelled, "Get the hell out of here!" For white upper-middle-class reporters like me, it may come as a shock that police can do these things and get away with it. I would like to believe that freedom of speech is protected in our country and that the police exist to protect such freedoms. I hope that, unlike me, other journalists do not need to endure attacks by police to begin reporting critically on police conduct. We have a civic responsibility to stop accepting police statements and start holding these people accountable. Will Potter is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. In his spare time, he independently covers politics and social movements. He has written for the Chicago Tribune, the Dallas Morning News, and the Texas Observer. And this particular article can be seen on the www.counterpunch.org website of April 19th of this year. You can actually go back to that date, I guess that's yesterday, and check it out. So, in the meantime, check this out.
Is there anybody here who'd like to change his clothes into a uniform? Is there anybody here who thinks they're only serving on a raging storm? Loyal to the end, whose duty is to die. I want to see him, I want to wish him love, I want to shake his hand, want to call his name, put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here who'd like to wrap the flag around an early grave? Is there anybody here who thinks they're standing tall around a battle wave? Is there anybody here who'd like to do his part? Soldier to the world and a hero to his heart. I want to see him, I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, want to call his name, put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here, proud of the parade, who'd like to give a cheer and show they're not afraid? I'd like to ask him what he's trying to defend. I'd like to ask him what he thinks he's gonna win. Is there anybody here who thinks that following the orders takes away the blame? Is there anybody here who wouldn't mind a murder by another name? Is there anybody here whose pride is on the line with the honor of the brave and the courage of the blind? I want to see him, I want to wish him luck, I want to shake his hand, want to call his name, put a medal on the man. Is there anybody here so proud of the parade, who'd like to give a cheer and show they're not afraid? I'd like to ask him what he's trying to defend. I'd like to ask him what he thinks he's gonna win. Is there anybody? by another name. Is there anybody here whose pride is on the line with the honor of the brave and the courage of the blind? I want to see him. I want to wish him luck. I want to shake his hand. Gonna call his name. Put a medal on the man. Put a medal on the man.
That was Phil Oakes from Tape from California way back, many, 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 some decades ago anyway. 1974, Chords of Fame, actually, not Tape from California. Sam Farr, that's the man who can't seem to ask the troops to get out of California, well, that'd be good too, but out of Baghdad and Basra and Iraq. We can't seem to get the uranium-depleted weapons out of Washington and out of the out of foreign countries. There's a group, PACT, People Against Corporate Thievery, that is having a forum, 7 p.m. Wednesday night, April 23rd, speaking on corporate fraud, reform, and accountability. And guest speakers include that very same congressional representative, Sam Farr, David Cowan, UCSC Professor of Economics, and Gloria Purdy, High Technology Financial Executive. This is all going to be at the Vets Hall at 846 Front Street, 7 p.m., Wednesday, April 23rd. Question and answer session to follow, free and open to the public, co-sponsored by UCSC Center for Justice, Tolerance, and Community UCSC Department of Economics, as well as WILP, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. For information, call Lucille Pine, 464-9652. And it's www.p-a-c-t.org, PACT, People Against Corporate Thievery. Farr will be showing up. I'm going to turn now to the city council tape, I think, if I can find the damn thing. I hope this is the right tape. let's see here. Having a little trouble doing the sleuthing here. That's what comes from having insufficient numbers of labels for your tapes. Well, let me remind you that you can call in at 427-3772 if you want to be a part of this discussion. We've had a couple callers already, and sometimes get a little heated back and forth, but it's good. Sometimes necessary to clarify what's going on. There's, as I mentioned before, the Capitola 13 will be having a press conference at 8 a.m. on Wednesday morning. That's the same Wednesday where this Farr thing is happening in the evening at 7 o'clock, the same Wednesday that follows the Santa Cruz City Council meeting, where we are not going to be able to hear the fine resolution by Scott Kennedy in opposition to the war in Iraq. And that probably that resolution really needs to be read aloud because it's never going to be read at the city council. Apparently Kennedy doesn't think it's important enough to put on the agenda. Maybe somebody can actually contact Councilmember Kennedy at 420-5022 and ask him just what happened to his resolution, 420-5022. I think I'm going to read this resolution. Whereas the City Council of Santa Cruz held a town meeting on Monday, April 7th to hear members of the public and community group comment on the war in Iraq, and whereas 36 individual members of the public and a dozen community organizations representing religious groups, organized labor veterans, homeless persons, and advocates of civil liberties, among others, spoke during the three-hour town meeting, and whereas those addressing the City Council raised a number of compelling legal, financial, and moral objections to the U.S. war in Iraq, and whereas the United States and a handful of allies initiated a preemptive attack on Iraq without demonstrating a credible threat to the people or country of the United States, and whereas the United States undertook the invasion and occupation of Iraq without a declaration of war by the U.S. Congress and without authorization by the United Nations, thereby violating the rule of law both within the United States and internationally, and whereas the threat of Iraq's alleged possession of weapons of mass destruction could have effectively been addressed by a rigorous and expanded regimen of UN weapons inspections, and whereas Saddam Hussein's egregious violations of the Iraqi people's human, civil, and cultural rights could have been effectively addressed by prosecution as crimes according to the standards of international humanitarian law rather than as a cause for war, And whereas the war in Iraq is being used as a pretext for to seriously erode constitutionally guaranteed civil liberties in the United States, and whereas the war in Iraq is contributing to the widespread environmental degradation of Iraq and the surrounding region, and whereas the war in Iraq is drawing scarce resources from much-needed expenditures to address education, housing, health care, environmental protection, and other domestic needs in our own society, and whereas the City Council is concerned for the well-being and safety of those serving in the armed forces of the United States and its allies, and whereas the City Council is concerned for the widespread loss of life by Iraqi civilians caused by the war in Iraq, and whereas the City Council is concerned about the destabilizing effects that the war in Iraq will have in the Middle East and elsewhere, and whereas the City Council is concerned that the war in Iraq will excite further attacks on the American people at home and overseas and lead to a protracted military occupation with continued repression of and suffering by the Iraqi people, and whereas the forces that have championed the attack in Iraq, including President Bush, have also threatened additional wars against other nations, the preemptive and first use of nuclear weapons, and preemptive and unilateral military action in defiance of the United Nations and international law, and whereas a permanent war footing is antithetical to a democratic society by increasing the power of and dependence on the military, and whereas a permanent war economy contributes to the concentration of economic resources and political power in the hands of a small sector of society and also further erodes democratic society, now, therefore, be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Santa Cruz expresses its continuing and adamant opposition to war by the United States against Iraq, and be it further resolved that the City Council supports those actions by Congress to deprive the President of the authority to wage war without prior congressional approval and declaration of war, and be it further resolved that the City Council calls for an immediate ceasefire to be monitored and enforced by the United Nations, and be it resolved that the City Council calls for the immediate withdrawal of all troops that have invaded Iraq, and be it further resolved, the City Council calls for a thorough investigation of the environmental effects of the 1990-91 Gulf War and the current war in Iraq, including especially the health and environmental impact and the steps necessary to mitigate any harmful effects of the production and use of depleted uranium weapons in the United States, Iraq, and elsewhere. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on the U.S. Congress to re-examine the Patriot Act and make revisions necessary to fully restore and respect constitutionally guaranteed rights. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on the U.S. Congress to initiate the necessary inquiries to determine whether President Bush has committed impeachable offenses by launching an illegal and immoral war. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on the U.S. Congress to restore recent cuts in veterans' benefits and to guarantee that all U.S. war veterans are assured health, housing, and other assistance commensurate with the sacrifice and commitment that they have made on behalf of our nation. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on Congress to appropriate sufficient funds to adequately address reconstruction in Afghanistan and Iraq. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on Congress to grant citizenship to all current members of the armed forces of the United States. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on Congress and the Bush administration to move immediately and decisively in cooperation with the United Nations to assure that UN resolutions are respected and a just and sustainable peace achieved between Israeli and Palestinian states. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on Congress to drastically reduce our military presence, including military bases, forward placement of troops and military advisors in the Persian Gulf and Middle East regions and elsewhere throughout the world. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on Congress to significantly reduce the U.S. participation in the international trade of weapons and weapons technology. And be it further resolved that the City Council calls on legislators at the state and federal level to pursue energy conservation and alternative energy technologies and renewable energy resources to diminish our nation's dependence on domestic and foreign fossil fuels. And be it further resolved that the City Council directs staff to prepare a brief pamphlet for distribution to all households in the City of Santa Cruz detailing the costs to the residents and businesses of the city of the defense budget and war in Iraq and summarizing the City Council's objections to the war in Iraq. And be it further resolved, the City Council will appoint a special task force to identify, evaluate, and return with special recommended actions for consideration by the City Council in order that the city and its residents might accept responsibility and make amends for our nation's war in Iraq, such as creating a sister city relationship with an Iraqi city, raising funds for humanitarian relief and reconstruction, etc. And be it further resolved, the City Council authorizes the mayor to send a copy of this resolution to elected representatives from the City of Santa Cruz, to the state and federal legislatures, to President Bush, and to the United Nations, passed and adopted this day, 8th day of June, April 2003. Of course, it wasn't. Nor will it be passed and adopted on the 22nd day of April. at the next council meeting, which comes up in 2 days here in Santa Cruz. It won't be proposed. It won't be passed. It won't even be discussed. Want to find out why? Call Scott Kennedy at 420-5020. He certainly will know. This is his resolution. Porter had a similar resolution that was shorter. I like Kennedy's resolution in many ways, although I got to say there's nothing about U.S. not cooperating, let's say, with corporations that are profiteering off of the Iraqi debacle, nor does it talk about police not cooperating with attempts to round up people who come here as to be as part of a sanctuary zone for soldiers and other war resistors. And in fact, there is not really anything concrete other than humanitarian aid that the U.S. is doing to, that the city council is suggesting Santa Cruz do to not cooperate, which I think is really the key. That's how you deprive the current government of legitimacy. You do not cooperate. You withdraw your cooperation. So, I know I have a list here of phone numbers of the Capitola 13. Again, these are folks, I'm one of them, who will be appearing in front of the courthouse on Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock for their arraignment. Now, they were originally going to be arraigned on charges of trespass with intent to interfere with a business, to wit, blocking the recruiting station. And the Capitola 13 have numerous legal strategies planned, which I am not authorized to divulge. But a trespass is a misdemeanor offense, and it means you get a jury trial, and if you can't afford a lawyer, a public defender is supposed to be appointed for you. Now the word is that in order to avoid this both jury trial and the appointment of public defenders, Bob Lee, the prosecutor, is going to charge everybody with infractions, which are smaller offenses. They involve no jail time, theoretically, although we've already been held in jail in the sense that we were booked, in the sense that we were actually not booked, but we were handcuffed, put into a police van, transported. The reason to be that they want to charge with infractions is that they do not have to deal with a lot of people going into court and demanding a public hearing in front of juries as to whether they were, committing a criminal offense, or were they engaging in a form of protected protest, or were they in fact obeying international law? I mean, these are all going to be issues that would have been heard by a jury, but now apparently, if lawyer Ed Fry's information is correct, and that's where I got this from, we're going to be going before some hack judge. Why do I say hack judge, potentially alienating the judicial officer who will be hearing us? Well, my view of the judicial system here is, based on experience, is rather skeptical. And I don't say that judges can't make fair decisions. I don't even say that they haven't made fair decisions in Santa Cruz. That's occasionally happened. But in terms of political protesters, and particularly homeless protesters, there is the scales are heavily weighted against the rights of the accused. That's been my experience. And let's see if the FBI is at the door. It looks like the FBI is not here, but we do have a guest who's here, two of them actually, questionable singers who put out the infamous Guns and Oil CD, and they will give them an opportunity to. Want to do a little a cappella singing for us?
I don't know if I can handle the a cappella singing, but maybe a couple of shots of whiskey.
Oh, well, here, let me give you a little something here. Give you a little whiskey. There we go. Drink that down. All righty. There you go. That feel better?
Oh, sure. Sure.
What's your name, sir?
My name is David Crace, and
Johnny Smith.
Yes, that's my kind of a joke name that was given to me in Los Angeles by some friends of mine that were just having a good time and trying to figure out something to call me that people could relate to.
What is this questionable woman with you? And what is she taking off over there, madam? We have a decent studio here. Just show some respect for the broadcast.
I thought the dress code was not in effect.
It's an undress code, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
So we're actually, I think what we're going to do now is once more play again the infamous Guns and Oil CD, which we played at the end of the last show, just to prove that we do, or at least I do on this show, occasionally play CDs that get sent my way. Though normally we try to get into civil rights CDs, you guys, so let's get on with a local Santa Cruz homeless CD, if you don't mind, next time. On this one occasion, we will allow you the this opportunity. Oh, you got some homeless on?
What? Second song is homeless.
Well, let's do the second song, by Cracky. Here we go.
We treat the homeless like discarded trash, never knowing what to do when we pass. When we pass, do I stare? Do I look away? I don't know. I ain't got very much to say to you. I'll give a nickel, I'll give a dime. I'll say I'm sorry, I haven't got the time for you. All the bricks in the window are all turning gray. The wind is blowing, I can't look away. All the stench of the homeless and the rotting streets are cast upon me like the shoes on my feet. Shoes on my feet.
I may be homeless, I'm not sore.
He's got his stocks and his mutual funds, and he'll tell you that his life is so much fun. So much fun. He's got an ulcer and addicted wife. Little Johnny's doing 25 years to life. Years to life. He's got a Lexus and a lot of cash, but the Christians say that stuff just won't last. It just won't last. So why do so many covet that stuff? I guess that Jesus just can't earn above. Earn above. Cause the bricks in the window are all turning gray. The wind is blowing, I can't look away. All the stench of the homeless and the rotting streets are cast upon me like the shoes on my feet. Shoes on my feet. Now get a job, you lazy bum. Can't you tell that life is so much fun? So much fun. Get a Lexus and get some cash. All your friends will think you made the big time at last. Big time at last. Now don't you worry, don't you fret, cause you ain't seen nothing yet. Save your nickels and save your times. Your God dollar bill will always come on time for you. Cause the bricks in the window are all turning gray. The wind is blowing, I can't look away. All the stench of the homeless and the rotting streets, I cast upon me like the shoes on my feet. We treat the homeless like discarded trash. We treat the homeless like discarded trash.
That was Homeless by Johnny Smith.
Yes, that was Homeless. And a little bit about, I've been a social worker for about 15 years, and a lot of the music that I write has is related to my life experience of working with homeless people. I've also worked in the South Bronx with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old children who were born addicted to crack cocaine or alcohol. So I guess a lot of what I'm trying to do is really just talk to people about a lot of the people in this world have been left behind because of our society embracing the values of materialism and greed, and just forgetting about our humanness. And that's really what I feel that that's important to me and important to the art that I'm trying to do. And I just want to thank everybody for their support, and Robert for having me come down here and talk to you guys a bit. And that's about it. Thank you.
Actually, there's another edition of Johnny's Hollywood, which I guess Coral Rock sings, previously known as the Brune Babe. She's moved up from that sexist, demeaning position to rock on. Coral, any comments about your version of Homeless, which we're going to hear later?
Yes, I'm the a cappella wonder behind the Smith. So I add a lot of flavor and melody to the homeless issues on the Homeless CD, which is sold at Streetlight, on the Hollywood CD. Did I say that?
Yes,
happy Easter.
Johnny Smith, Hollywood, and you've actually brought us some chocolate Easter eggs, as well as some questionable sidewalk chalk Easter eggs. Very interesting. Sergeant Baker will hear of this.
Yes, it's for Becky and Robert. Happy Easter.
Thank you, you bunny. Do I get a hug? Oh, you should see this.
Oh, my goodness.
Bunny's hugging in the studio.
It's pretty exciting, man. Thank you, Coral. And thank you, John. You're welcome to hang. I'm going to roll forward. I'll actually be playing this, the Coral Rock version of Hollywood, or the Johnny Smith and Coral Rock version of Hollywood, a little bit later in the show. And for the moment, however, we're going to turn to the shitty council with a rather shitty recording of that particular session, which was 2 weeks ago. This was a session where I attended the afternoon session, the beginning of the evening session with a couple of other folks, because in the afternoon you get a chance to pull items off the agenda and give you should get 3 minutes, but Emily Riley in her divine wisdom has decided people are going to get 2 minutes, even if there are only two or three speakers, because the city council, don't you know, is very busy and wants to hear itself talk, but doesn't want to hear the community talk. Here we have a call. Hi, you're on free radio.
Hi, Robert. I'm sorry to call back another time. This is Doug.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're talking about songs. It's an interesting thing. The first song the first album that Leon Russell put out with Mark Bino, I can't remember the name of it. I think it's just Leon Russell, but it's with Mark Bino. There's a song that they didn't put on the album, but on the new CD, there's one that they did called Hollywood, and it's really kind of appropriate for today, even. And that was made about 30 years ago.
Hmm.
Anyway, just to tell you that, you know, it's the Hey Brother, You Guess There a Quarter and stuff like that. It was the same old place 30 years ago as it is today, pretty much. And it's just grown up and down. It's just grown a lot.
Okay,
anyway,
well.
But it was an interesting song that they have on there if you get the CD. But it's Leon Russell and Mark Bino.
All right. Well, thank you, Doug.
I got it. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, yeah, The local studio guests here, or studio crashers, I don't know what to call them, crashers, guests, whatever you will, non-FBI members here, as far as I know. They did bring along their box cutters, though, so watch out. But they have no airline tickets, so we should be happy for that. Free Radio Santa Cruz is what you're tuned to, 96.3 FM. And let's go to the shitty council, see what they have to say or what they don't have to say. Actually, you're going to hear testimony from the public, like me, in other words. Me, me, me. That's what this show is mostly about, unfortunately, until you call in.
Council members of the community, 2 minutes. I see we have a lot of people in the room, and there's not much time for people to speak. And that's a joke, because there aren't very many people in the room, and there is time for people to speak. This is about the public employees retirement system. In essence, what it is a large giveaway to the police and fire department, 3% retirement at 50, which adds $1.2 million per year to the city budget. And I want to point out that this city council used the $1.2 million problem as the excuse to destroy the Citizens Police Review Board in January. Yet here, we see them lavishing benefits on the police department and the fire department. I'm not sure if this isn't beyond that of other cities as well. Now, I understand that to some extent it may be locked in because of the memorandum of understanding that you came up with and you decided to dicker away the funds of the city to the police in this situation. But I'm concerned that if there is any way, because you claim that a fiscal crisis is what is motivating the destruction of citizen police oversight, that instead of giving more money not to police officers who are on duty, not to firemen who are working hard on duty, but this is a retirement benefit, $1.2 million retirement benefit to people, above and beyond what they have done actually serving the city. And I'm not saying that in some ideal universe they don't deserve this, but the question is, I think that you're going to be engaging in slashes of citizen oversight. You have to also consider some similar kind of reductions in the police department budget, which many people feel is bloated with gangs of six officers marching around giving tickets for sitting down on the sidewalk downtown. So my question to the council is if there's any way that the council can, I don't know, modify this agreement or come up with some kind of proposal to save money here, I think it should be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next speaker. Thank you, Johnson. On item number three as well. The city budget already spends 33% on the police department. The fire department, the Parks and Rec also have enforcement powers, and some Parks and Rec officers carry weapons. If you add that all up, it comes out to like over half of the city budget is already dedicated for some sort of police enforcement roles. Retirement age at age 65 to get Social Security benefits. 55 is a very common age for retirement. But this is age 50, some sort of special deal for police officers and fire officers. We have acute budget crises now. And you could mirror Governor Davis, who cut every single department in the state except for increased prison budget. You could mirror our federal government, which is spending billions and trillions on defense and on this war in Iraq. I ask you to draw the line somewhere, you know? Let's change our priorities so that we're not spending so much money on police and enforcement and jails and special deals for the police and more for the everything else we need, you know, roads and schools and health care. And a place for homeless people to live. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Mr. Porter?
I just want to say that being a teacher, I certainly understand and have sympathy with the opinions Ms. Johnson just expressed for priorities and spending. I agree. However, she mentioned the governor, and the governor is probably the key in this particular item. The governor, way back, I think before his re-election campaign, set this up, recommended it to the legislature, got passed by the legislature, and virtually every law enforcement agency in the state has adopted this. And were we not to adopt it, we wouldn't be able to recruit. It's that simple. And so this, I don't completely agree that this is the smartest fiscal thing the city would ever do, but at some point our hands became tied if we want to have quality people recruited by our police department. We don't have a lot of choice. Now, it may bankrupt the city. That's a considerable possibility in my mind. But the governor is still the governor, and I don't think that the legislature is ready to repeal the action that they took. So I'm afraid we have to go along with this at this time. It's a mixed blessing, I'm afraid. So I'll move to adoption of item 3, the first contract amendment.
Second. Okay. All those in favor?
I would, for the public that's watching this meeting on television, I'd also like to just state that the City Council adopted a very strong civilian review of police system that will save approximately 50% of the funds that we were spending in previous years on civilian review. The committee that worked closely closely in developing that proposal, is confident that it'll be more efficient and more effective than the previous system, and just for the sake of the public, when we acted on that, Mr. Norris was neither present nor commented on that system, seems to be unaware of what the council's done, and the idea that it's been eliminated or significantly damaged is a complete misrepresentation of the situation.
Point of privilege, and then mentioned, I'd like to respond to that.
I just want to say that I certainly don't understand all the inner workings of state legislation and the governor's office, etc. But I do understand that these considerations for law enforcement and for firefighters stem from the belief, the fact that these are the people that our society puts in harm's way for our own protection. These are the people who risk their income-bearing years and their lives and their health for the rest of the citizens. And I think that what we're talking about here is the way in which society measures the value of that sacrifice. And it may not make full fiscal sense, and it may be a result of the bargaining strength of one collective bargaining unit or another. I don't know, but I know that I believe that when we talk about benefits to public safety officers, that we acknowledge the fact that these are people, unlike any other jobs in our community, these are people who are putting themselves at risk to benefit the community.
One of the things Chief Beltra always says when he's swearing in a new officer is that remember that when other people are running away from the scene of an accident, you're the one who's running toward it. And that's certainly been my experience during ride-alongs, is that there always comes a moment in the evening where the police officer says to me, stay in the car. And I do. And they can't. And that's worth a lot.
Sure. What?
And all this is discussion, again, on the item about... record keeping? No, it's about retirement benefits for huge amounts of retirement benefits for police and fire in order to match what the governor's benefits were. Not any attempt to change it, an attempt to challenge it, but to match it. And, you know, it's going to be argued, you're going to hear Mike Rutkin for the first time probably in history not criticizing me. Well, certainly not in history, but it's rare when He kind of gives myself and the other speaker, Becky Johnson, who was a critic of this proposal, a backhanded compliment and criticizes the governor for raising these levels so that he says the city had to pay more, kind of blackmail kind of thing, or they'd lose their police officers. But all this elaborate praise for the police department, endless praise for the police department, uncritical praise for the police department, without any kind of really meaningful critical analysis of what the police department is doing. I mean, certainly you want to praise good police work, but when you also have a police department that engages in the shooting of Happy John Dine with no meaningful consequences, or the shooting of Quentin Martin, the fellow who was shot in the car, the bank robber who was shot, And the claim was that his weapon fired when they found it, reached his weapon, it was completely inoperable. When you don't get a fair deal from this police department, when you don't get candid responses, the last thing we need is Mayor Riley and Councilmember Premack and Councilmember Kennedy, for that matter, praising the police department. Kennedy was praising the police review board. Actually, there is no police review board. He was praising the appointment of an attorney from Palo Alto, Bob Aronson, who is now being paid half of what the CPRB was being paid to come down once or twice a month and review complaints. There's no public process anymore at all. There's no way of any kind of public policy debate, since Kennedy's public safety committee, or whoever's doing that, well, Kennedy was supposed to be holding meetings with Riley on this new auditor system, but instead they rammed it through with no meetings. He's correct in saying I wasn't at the council meeting where it was given the rubber stamp, and the reason I wasn't there was because anything I would have said would have been ignored, and there was no meaningful public process. There was no need for me to come to that meeting. I'd actually made my criticisms the meeting before and the meeting before that, and I'll continue to make them. And But they only mean something when masses in the community stand up and make those criticisms. You're hearing the Santa Cruz City Council meeting of April 8th in the afternoon session. Here's some more from the consent agenda, the agenda that's usually rammed through without a dissenting voice and a dissenting vote. We pulled items off the agenda to discuss them. And on this one rare occasion, the council is actually taking up a discussion, though the discussion is happening after the item has been voted on. So it's actually sort of a way of dealing with our comments in a somewhat meaningless context. They're just sort of speaking to the public, trying to counteract what we said.
I have a comment on this, but since others have, I won't add this on.
All of the other,
irrespective of the comments which I would join and don't disagree with about the
Councilmember Rutkin.
Risks taken by public safety officers, this thing is this 3% at 50 is a fiscal disaster. It's going to destroy cities all over the state. And as a result, as Ed accurately represented in his comments, that was forced upon us by a decision by the governor to provide that kind of benefit system or retirement system for the State Highway Patrol and for the people who work in the corrections facilities. And the reality is, it wasn't the bargaining strength of local unions that brought this about. It was the fact that if we don't put this into place, we will end up with the quality of officers and firefighters and others that are lower than other, significantly impaired. And we put ourselves at risk by not hiring the most qualified and prepared people to do this kind of work. And so we had no choice. And it's a fiscal disaster. I completely agree with both Becky and Robert about the impacts of this. It's a disaster. We're talking about millions of dollars in local government. And for us, certainly more than $1 million and $2 million of disastrous funding that we don't have. And we simply don't have any choice but to spend it. And it's outrageous that we're stuck in that position. And that's not to say that people are not taking huge risks and safety officers. But they don't need to have, I don't believe, a 3% at 50 retirement system as reward for that. There are other kinds of compensation issues. They need to have that here because they've got it everywhere else in the state, and if we didn't do it, we would be at a huge disadvantage, even fiscally disadvantaged, because the turnover cost of training new officers who take 6 months to a year to train would be more than this benefit system if we didn't have the same system everybody else does. So even makes fiscal sense for us to do this, even though it makes no fiscal sense of the overall system-wide plan that this happened to us. But this happened to us. This was not something we chose freely.
Number 20 is a resolution for securing the acceptance of California law enforcement program funds. I have no objection to this, but it's a funding for technical items. And my concern is that we currently aren't using our technical facilities within the police department for speed enforcement. The city has a plague of being unable to do radar enforcement on its streets because of the previous enactment of the 25-mile-per-hour self-imposed speed limit. This 25-mile-per-hour self-imposed random speed limit has been rejected by the courts as being inappropriate for the establishment of enforcement of radar. So now we have technical facilities within our police department that cannot be used, because in many of our streets, the courts,
is a conservative to the right of the council. He's speaking.
So I'd like to send assurance that this $24,127.42 of technical equipment, which consists of visual equipment, will be accepted by the city council, and that we won't go about some sort of privacy statement of the police department having some visual equipment, similar to what we've done for the use of radar.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Well, we have two more speakers, actually.
I'm sorry.
I can
wait.
Mr. Norris?
Okay. This is, again, about accepting a grant from the California Law Enforcement Equipment Program. And I'm just wondering what kind of strings come attached to this. I know the council has been concerned about bogus drug enforcement activity by the feds, and I would hope to some extent that happens by the state. I'm also concerned that this is a situation where you're getting funding for technical equipment for the police around, which I think I'm not entirely clear on what this is for. I've looked at the staff report, in-car video systems and mobile data computers. I'm wondering, still a fan of dealing with the alleged racial profiling issue that has come up repeatedly and been ignored, although the late Citizens Police Review Board, which was hastily replaced after private meetings by Kennedy and Riley with the current auditor without any meaningful public input. I'm just wondering if this equipment is part of the long-promised, endlessly delayed computer material that will somehow allow for some objective analysis to whether there actually is racial profiling going on, and to in some extent serve as a kind of oversight to police, because if there's a video record of arrests, obviously that serves as some kind of a deterrent, theoretically, if the police use it consistently on improper arrests and improper police behavior. So I notice we have Chief Belcher in the back here. Perhaps he could give us some kind of update on what's going on, what this equipment would be used for, and whether, in fact, it is related to some kind of furtherance of dealing with the concerns of the African-American and Latino communities about racial profiling, which is a massive concern everywhere in the state, and, yes, is also a concern here in dear little old Santa Cruz. So that's a question I have for the council. Thanks.
Mr. Norris, I'm interested in what's the basis for your statement that I met, that I had a private meeting with the auditor without benefit of public participation. I'm not aware of such a meeting.
Okay, you misunderstood.
What is the basis?
Sure, you misunderstood what I said. If you review what I said, you'll see I said you had private meetings creating the auditor system. You and Emily Riley had meetings around that issue. You know that's the case.
Thank you very much for your comments. Next speaker, David Johnson. Item number 20. I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's having the oversight for police stops, of the objective oversight of a videotape is very helpful. And it's also very helpful when a defendant gets to court and they have a police report and they say the police report does not reflect what happened. If there's a videotape, I think that's also very helpful, because we all want to know what the truth is. This is $24,000 or more. Or we think of this as free money, but of course it's not. It comes from the state of California, and from all of us pay state taxes too. I urge you not to think of that. Be careful about how you spend the money, even if it does seem like it's just comes in from without. My third concern is that this is about creating a digital data system, which again I think is a good idea to have that. Although in a recent case of mine, when I went to get some discovery for some of my chalk arrest tickets, I was told that all records had been expunged for any further back than 2 years. I think this is a bad practice, and so if we have a digital data system, I think that those records, we should keep those in perpetuity for a very, very long time, so that we can, as a community, gauge how we're doing and compare things, and that data is invaluable to us for how to proceed in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Motion to move the comment.
First a comment and then a motion. This item.
Do you want to speak on number 20? Come forward, I dare.
Yes, about some of that money for video cameras to the citizens so that they can document when police officers are doing these kinds of profiling and selective enforcements, so that somebody could, I would certainly have liked to have one to be able to show that those three officers just walked right past those people walking the dog. Well, I suppose it was more important to harass someone for sitting on the sidewalk.
Thank you very much.
First of all,
and I'm afraid I may have to cut Mike Rutkin off. Sorry. Yeah, I apologize, by the way, for the different volume levels you're forced to use, you listeners at home, because of the... one of the problems is that the tape recording equipment is not the best, and it also it comes off of a speaker that's distant, and then when we play it through the miserable equipment in the studio here, it's double trouble. So you got to be dedicated to catch this stuff, and hopefully we'll have one of you donate a nice VCR machine, and I can play the actual better audio quality video tape, which has a good audio track. Anyway, that was from the City Council session of April 8th. Had to do with it's an example of the kinds of discussions you get into, which essentially the council ignores, other than simply commenting on. But it's a form of public education for those who want to use the time. Whereas normally you only get 3 minutes, and that if you haven't spoken the week before, during the 7 o'clock oral comment period, the oral communications or public comment. On the items that come up on the agenda, if you want to make pertinent comments on agenda items, you usually can have at least 2 minutes, unless you're Fitzmaurice and giving me 30 seconds, and that's happened on occasion. But if you're not me, you usually get 2 minutes at least, and sometimes 3 minutes on these other items, and that's an opportunity to speak to those items and also to bring in other issues too, as they pertain to items on the agenda. And now I want to remind people that on the agenda tomorrow, not tomorrow, Tuesday. There isn't going to be anything on the issue of the war, which is really too bad, because that's what we, you know, a lot of us had hoped to have a city council resolution, if not against the war, then at least against the occupation. And the long Kennedy resolution that I read before, not a bad resolution, though, as I said, it doesn't have enough specifics about what Santa Cruz City can do to instruct its bureaucrats, its administrators, its people who, its investment counselors, or the people who invest its funds, into dealing, you know, into putting them into companies that don't have ties with the Pentagon, that don't have ties with the Halliburton and the other companies that are rebuilding at U.S. expense and at the expense of the Iraqi people with these huge lucrative projects, the war-torn landscape in Iraq. We don't have any of that. But, you know, you have the basic statement, get out of there now, come back, this is an illegal war, impeach Bush. A lot of these messages that did come out of the town hall meetings were in the Kennedy resolution, and it has evaporated. It is gone. It ain't there no more, folks. If you want to find out why, you can call Riley at 420-5022. She's our mayor. Or you can call Kennedy at 420-5020, at which point you'll be thrown into a Byzantine voicemail system where you'll be told to push a dial and you'll push a button and you'll get Kennedy. So you might want to do that right now. You can do it on the weekend. It's a 24-hour number. Why isn't the anti-war resolution going on the agenda? 420-5020, 420-5022. And you can also contact Representative Farr at 429-1976, 429-1976, and say, Farr, are you going to move to get the troops out of there or not? What's going on? So those are options you have. What I'm going to turn to now, and there's actually more of that afternoon session, but we don't have time for it, is the infamous chalking bust of March 18th. Now, this if you want to see a chalking trial, there's one actually coming up on Wednesday. Chelsea Hodge, who is one of the co-founders of the Vigil Against Two Wars, that vigiled against the war in Iraq and the war on the poor in Santa Cruz and Cooper and Pacific Streets, and went on for 6 days until the police shut it down, in essence. She was ticketed along with 4 or 5 other people for chalking peace slogans and statements on the sidewalk, an erasable chalk sold across the street at Palace Arts Stationery. And Judge Irwin Joseph has already ruled that chalking is defacing the sidewalk. Get that. He wants to sort of line up with a redevelopment agency in the city hall and has done so. It has not reached a high, actually it reached one court up, Attic, Kelly, and I think Yance, maybe, I'm not sure about the third judge, that was Danner, agreed that that chalking was defacing the sidewalk, and it was not constitutionally protected. So I believe that's the Becky Johnson case. It's going to be appealed further, and we'll see about that. I was arrested for chalking. My case has finally reached the court. I'm going to be setting a court date in June, and it's going to be interesting because they're accusing me of chalking the sidewalk when, in fact, I chalked the street, or at least that's where the chalk appeared. I'm not making any confessions here on the radio yet, although there may be a key witness. They may be flying in a witness from Washington to show that somebody looking like me, probably an imposter, chalked "No War" on the sidewalk next to this vehicle that was covered with bumper stickers. So that's going to be a pretty exciting trial. It's not a jury trial. It's going to be a trial before a judge. And, of course, the issue here is how many police officers does it take to arrest a person chalking no war on the sidewalk? And the answer in my case was six. That's how many showed up. If you include the hosts and the and Sergeant Baker viewing from afar. And what I'm going to play now is the tape of that interaction. And I'm also going to stop the tape. And with the remaining 20 minutes we have in this hour, I'm going to kind of make it a demonstration of some concerns and considerations for individuals faced with police interrogation, detention, arrest, what kinds of options, at least from my perspective, you have. And I want to remind you that I'm not a lawyer, which actually should be on the positive side, that I'm not even a paralegal, but that I'm an individual who has some opinions on these issues and has been to court about 100 times as a, well, 50 to 100 times as a defendant, and probably three or four times that number of times as a witness or as a spectator or as a reporter. So listen to this tape of March 13th. This is the arrest of Robert Norris, also known as Robert Norris Khan, for chalking no war on Pacific Avenue next to a suspicious-looking red station wagon covered with questionable bumper stickers.
What's up, officer?
I see your ID, please.
What's the reason you're stopping me for?
I'll explain it to you when I have the ID.
No, I'd like to know what crime I'm being suspected of before you tell me.
Now, this was Officer Phelps who approached me and wanted to see my ID. Now, if an officer approaches you on the street and asks to see your ID, the most immediate thing to say is, am I under arrest? Notice I didn't do this. There are a number of things I didn't do that I would have wished I had done, but I'm going to kind of point out to you what you can do. This is what the ACLU used to recommend whenever you're approached by a police officer. Simply state, am I under arrest? And if they say no, then you say, officer, here is my name and my address. And you don't have to prove it. You just have to give it to them and say, am I free to go? I want to go home and go about my business. And if they say no, then you say, am I under arrest? You repeat. And if they say yes, you can say, good, what's the charge? And then they are forced to make a statement about what they claim is illegal behavior on your part. Now, what you're going to hear shortly is Officer Phelps saying that I am under detention. And this is the latest sort of hike around basic civil rights that, or I should say skip, dance, song and dance, skip to Maluma Darlin, that the police use to get around the issue of, they don't want to say you're under arrest because this makes them liable for a false arrest. They would rather say you're being detained. But, and here's some clarifications, if you are being arrested, the police have to have probable cause to arrest you. This is the same standard, it's not as high as beyond a reasonable doubt to prove that you're guilty at a jury trial, but it implies a certain amount of evidence that you are, that there's reason to believe that you have committed the crime. In fact, probable cause is also the standard for getting a search warrant from a court. So it has a certain level there. It's up there. It's beyond 51%. It has to be a significant probability. And police are kind of, you know, a little wary about that standard. Now, the standard below that for a detention is less. A detention doesn't require probable cause. It requires reasonable suspicion. Reasonable suspicion is less than probable cause. What does it mean? Well, first of all, they have to have a sense that a crime has been committed. They have to know that. So they have to be able to tell you what crime has been committed that they have reasonable suspicion that you're involved with. And that's the first thing you ask. What crime has been committed that you need to detain me to talk about? The second thing, of course, is you don't have to talk about anything. Even though you're not, you're not officially a suspect. Well, you are, actually, because you're under reasonable suspicion. You're being detained. You don't have to say anything. Usually this process is used to harass young people and search for their, do a warrant check on them. And it can also be legitimately used if the police see an individual that they think may fit the description of somebody who was at a robbery, then they might want to bring the eyewitness over to look at the person. And then if the person says, yeah, then they'll have probable cause to arrest you for that crime based on that individual's identification. But reasonable suspicion is not simply a cop saying, sit down, stay there, and shut up. That's not reasonable suspicion. That's unreasonable, tyrannical behavior by a police officer. And unfortunately, that's the kind of shit we usually get downtown on the mall. So the advice here is to first say, am I under arrest? And if they say, no, you're under detention, then your next question is, you got to say, what crime are you investigating? And they say, be quiet and stay right there, and say, no, officer, I intend to leave unless you either arrest me or tell me what crime you're investigating, because I don't believe there's a basis for my staying. You don't have to explain it any further. That's my understanding based on my discussions with the public defender's office. Let's hear more of this chalk crime as it unfolds. I remind you, it's March 13th. It's late afternoon. I am standing near Artisans, the shop near the Cooper House, and I'm approached by Officer Phelps, who asks for my ID.
And I don't have to explain it to you until I get your ID.
You need to tell me what crime you're investigating, even if you're detaining me. There has to be reasonable suspicion, and you have to tell me specifically.
And you need to hand me your ID. You're in violation of the Penal Code Section 148.9.
I dispute that with you, officer. First of all, you know who I am. Secondly,
I need your identification.
Why is that, officer?
Because you're talking on the street over here.
So the crime you're investigating is chalking.
I'm not investigating it. You're getting a citation for it.
Well, that's fine. Why didn't you just say so in the first place?
I'm not going to play this game with you, Robert. I need your ID.
I like being treated courteously, officer. That's the problem. If you're going to give me a citation, it's very simple to say so.
I'm always courteous.
No, you weren't giving me the specific information that you were obliged to do.
I'm not required to do that until I get your ID.
If you're detaining me, that's one that you don't. I have the right to request.
You need to read the law.
No, I have read the law, and I believe you're mistaken, frankly.
Get your ID. I'm going to ask you to sit on the bench, please. Sit down on the bench, please.
Why do I have to sit on the bench, officer?
Because I asked you to do so. It's an officer's safety reason. Sit down on the bench.
I'm not about to attack you.
I didn't say you would. Sit down, please.
I'd prefer to stand, but I'm not going to attack you. I'm not a menace to you in any way, so I'm going to stand here.
I'm going to ask you one more time to sit down, and then I'm going to call another officer over.
You have a right to call an officer over. I'm not going to hurt you in any way. I'm standing here peaceably. I mean, I have a witness as well. Can you take a picture of this, please? Thank you.
I don't have a camera.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here. Officer Gray, chalking on the sidewalk ticket, folks.
He's not under arrest.
I actually am under arrest while I'm being ticketed. That is correct.
I cannot arrest for infraction.
It is a non-custodial arrest. I am under arrest. If I walk away, I will be taken into custody. This is a chalking ticket, folks. I'm being arrested for chalking. It's not a custodial arrest, but I am being arrested for... I don't know quite what the circumstances are, but that's what I'm being arrested for.
Is the current address, Robert?
It is. Correct. Harassment for chalking downtown, folks. And I suspect it's an anti-war message. Your taxpayer dollars at work. Four police officers for one chalker. Four police officers, folks. Good use of taxpayer money.